Mouse Audio Podcast Network.
It's time to get ooky, it's time to get spooky with Whining About Herstory. And today we are joined by two very special spooky bitches, Ellen and Sam of the Chaos Cast. Woo-hoo. Woo! October's turning out to be like a really big month for us, yeah, which was just unexpected. We did that interview and now we're having Ellen and Sam on. And also, this is our special video Patreon episode. So if you're a patron, you're getting to see that we're all in Halloween costumes. And we have already decided that Sam is my counterpart for the Chaos Cast because we both decided to dress as Rosie the Riveter.
No planning went into this.
No. I like literally yesterday, I was like, BT Dubs, you guys want to do costumes for this? And they were like, yeah.
They were super accommodating. Yes. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for accommodating our lack of preparation and unprofessionalism. But as always, I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And Ellen and Sam, do you guys want to introduce yourselves and tell everyone about your amazing podcast?
Yeah, yeah. I'm Ellen. Hello.
And I'm Sam. We're from the Chaos Cast. If you want to find us, because we're just like super fun and cool and you love this episode, you can find us on all the normal platforms. Just search Chaos Cast. We're also on Instagram at Chaos Podcast, on Twitter at _ Chaos Podcast. And you can send us an email at chaospodcast21@gmail.com. And yeah, that's us.
And we will also be putting your details in the episode description. So
thank you. Ellen, what new thing do we have?
We have stickers.
She's right. We did just recently get stickers.
Oh,
this is exciting.
I that's how you stickers. Know you're a real podcast, when you have stickers.
We are currently trading those stickers for reviews, just in case anyone wants to do that.
I'll trade you a sticker for a sticker.
And a coaster.
Yeah, I will also make that deal.
Yes. Okay. We're like Shark Tank. Like, it's a deal. I will take 1% of your stickers for 1% of my stickers.
Right. So we will also say that Sam and Ellen and then Chaos Cast is a relatively new podcast. They started this year, right? You're on episode like 16, I think.
Yeah,
17 this coming Tuesday. So they released the day after us. So you can listen to us and then the next day you can listen to them. And it'll be great because we release Mondays and you release Tuesdays.
Also, they're so ahead of the game because we didn't start collaborating with people until like way deep into our podcast journey. And they're like, oh, episode 17. Hey, and they reached out to us. Like, we're so bad at initiating stuff. And I listened to them. I was like, I love these people. Why? Like, oh my goodness. If you can't tell.
So much. You guys are like such a fun vibe. And we like people. Well, I like people. And Ellen does what I say.
Yeah, I'm the technical twin. Yep. I'm also the technical support.
Sam, so was the idea, was the podcast also kind of your idea? And you were like, hey, Ellen.
A little bit, yeah.
Oh my God, yes. Okay, so Sam is my soulmate. We're going to run off together. and then we'll drive like each other nuts.
All right, I have to go beat Sam up now.
Like 6 months before we were set to graduate college, Sam like started dropping hints and they got progressively more aggressive.
Yeah, because we lived together all through, where for the last 2 years of our undergrad, and while we were living together, I was always like kind of sad. I was like, we're not going to live in the same city when we graduate. And I was like, you know what we could do when we graduate, so we still have to talk to each other fairly regularly? Start a podcast.
Oh my God. Seriously, if anyone's looking for a way to bond with their bestie, a podcast is a great way to do it.
It's really fun.
So we have a very special spooky episode for you today. Our regular listeners know in October we cover some women on the darker side of herstory. And today we are, each of our podcast teams are covering a woman from our respective states who falls on the darker end of history. And in our case, we're covering like 5 women who may have totally murdered someone, but we don't know. So,
well, and here's my question, because they're in different states. So yeah. Which state did you pick?
So I picked the state that neither of us are currently in.
But are you from that state?
I am.
Well, good enough.
What state is that?
We like met and we fell in love.
So. Oh, okay. Well, that is your home. That's like your birthplace. Yeah. That's where the podcast was born.
Exactly.
That's where it was a twinkle in your eye.
Serial killer.
Gone forever.
Can I just say that Georgia has some spooky shit going on. So I am very, very excited to hear what you guys came up with. Because immediately I'm like, there's so much shit going down in Georgia. The devil's down there. I hear he plays the fiddle. Like, you know, it's
when
nuts.
When he's not on his island.
He's when he's Georgia. Not on Satan's sex island.
Part of the song is the devil goes down to Georgia, which implies either two things. One, Georgia's lower than hell, which... or two, the devil is a northerner, which also...
Yeah.
Yeah, so the devil summers in Minnesota, and then he winters in Georgia.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, exactly. We figured out the devil's travel plans. See, women get shit done.
Exactly.
We already know where the devil is.
Preparing to go to Georgia for the winter?
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's sealing up his home back in Minnesota, winterproofing it, lining up a house sitter. Like, he's got people.
Of course. I mean, if not, he just, like, that's convinces
what you,
them.
That's what you have to do when you lose the fiddle contest with the devil. You have to watch his house in Minnesota over the winter. Hell really does freeze over, folks.
The equivalent of selling your soul.
Yes.
No, you win, you get to keep your soul. You lose, you have to go to Minnesota all winter.
Yep.
Yeah.
That seems fair.
Yeah, actually, that is how everyone in Minnesota ended up here. I'm terrible at playing the fiddle. I talked a big game and I did not deliver.
It's just the super secret that we just don't tell anyone. We're oh, not yeah. all nice. We all just sold our souls to the devil.
Yeah. Well, because you are our guest and we love you so much, Ellen and Sam are going to kick off with their ghostly, gory Georgia gal.
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you guys about Anjette Donovan Lyles, who is one of only two female serial killers I could find in Georgia. And this was the further in history one, so I felt more comfortable talking about it.
I'm so excited. I've never heard
I
of her.
I think Georgia's lying. I'm pretty sure they've two. Had more than two.
Oh, yeah.
They're just better serial killers because they don't get caught.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, it's like that southern politeness, that charm, where it's like, well, you don't ask a lady those questions. You ask a lady what she has buried under her floorboards. That's rude.
You guys are going to enjoy this because it does get weirdly sexist for no reason at the end.
Oh, love it.
That.
Cross off your Herstory bingo cards. We have sexism. Surprise.
But like any good story, we can start at the beginning. We have Anjette Donovan, who was born in Macon, Georgia on August 23rd, 1925. And I have a very important question for Ellen. Who do we know from Macon? I know it's someone.
I think Jackie lives near Macon.
I'll take it.
Okay.
This name has been like rattling around my brain for 2 days of like, I know, like I texted all, like a bunch of our friends being like, are you from Macon? And all of them were like, no, but I know someone's from Macon.
You also have to drive through Macon to get anywhere cool.
Okay. But I did look this up, and Macon is about an hour and a half drive from our old apartment.
Oh, not that far.
No. But yes, Anjette Donovan was the only daughter of Jetta Watkins and William Donovan, who owned and operated a produce stand in the area. Just fun facts about her childhood, because there wasn't a lot about it before the murder started.
That sounds about
they're,
right.
They're making babies in Macon Bank in Macon, Georgia.
Oh, my
mm-hmm.
God.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I'm that person, so deal with it.
So from a very young age, she was known to be very pretty. She was known to be very manipulative. Ooh. And know how to bend people to her will to get what she wanted.
So she's a teenage girl.
Yeah, but like that was the information girl. I found about her on the internet was like before she started murdering. That's what people said about her, was that she was a very manipulative person,
but very pretty. So you know it balances out.
Yeah, she was Georgina from Mean Girls. Georgina from Georgia.
Yeah, we've already got sexism when Ted Bundy murders people. People are all like, "Oh, he was so charming. I can't believe it."
You know, this woman, everyone was like, she was the most charming person I know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but that's actually a good point, because Ted Bundy, it's like, oh, he's so charming and, you know, he's just able to wow women with his wiles. And it's like, no, she's a manipulative bitch.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, that is the mood we're starting off on here. But for the real start of her story is in 1947 when she married Ben F. Lyles Jr. He had fought in World War II. He was the owner and operator of Lyles Restaurant in downtown Macon, which was a family restaurant that his parents, Julia and Ben Sr., had started. And the two of them were pretty happy for a hot minute. They had a nice little apartment on the main street. They had two daughters, Marcia in 1948 and Carla in 1951. They ran the restaurant together. And Jet quickly got a reputation for being very good with difficult customers. And I have a really solid quote when you think about the fact that she's going to murder a bunch of people. So I'm going to read it to you. Someone who frequented her restaurant once said, "Going to her restaurant, you didn't think about the food as much as you thought about just being welcome. She hugged everybody's neck when they walked in the door. She would come to each table and sit down and talk. She had a personality that was terrific. It was a pleasure to go to her restaurant. You couldn't help but like her."
That is the nicest Yelp review I have ever heard.
Right? Five stars, like the hugs.
Yeah, five stars for hugs.
Later on, multiple people said the food was okay, but it became a really popular restaurant to hang out with Andrette, pretty much.
I feel people's opinions on the restaurant and the food probably changed after they found out she was a nut job. They're like, "Oh my god, I have the best eggs Benedict here that I've ever had in my life." And then later, it's like, I mean, they were kind of runny. They were okay. Nothing to write home about.
Now see, you think it would be the opposite, that they would grade the food more after they found out she was crazy, because then you're going to see a crazy person versus, "No, the food was delicious. I totally went for the food. It wasn't for her at all."
They have really good Bloody Marys, though. That's the one thing they do very well.
So I actively tried to find a menu for this restaurant online, and I just couldn't.
They really did. They have lava beans?
I don't know.
I was thinking fried green tomatoes, because when I think of the South, I think of fried green tomatoes.
I was thinking avocado, because that's on everything.
Yeah, but that's on everything now.
She was a trailblazer.
She's ahead of her time.
Yeah.
Avocado, fava beans, and fried green tomatoes. That was their entire menu.
Solid menu.
But then things start to take a turn. Ben Lyles Jr. had what most likely was some undiagnosed PTSD, coupled with a throat infection and rheumatic fever from injuries he sustained in the war. Jeez. Which I looked up rheumatic fever because I'd never heard of it before, and it's what happens if you don't treat strep throat properly. So take antibiotics.
Yeah.
So my mom was right that you have to take your medicine. Mm-hmm.
And these issues made him very irritable. He started drinking a lot and gambling. He was declared disabled by the Army Hospital in Georgia and got a pension. But he was getting really in debt from the gambling, so he sold the restaurant to pay off some of his debt.
Oh, no.
Without asking Anjette.
Oh, no.
You don't do that.
So she was really mad, and she never forgave him. And also, because the drinking was getting worse, his pension was reduced because alcoholism isn't a disability in the Army's eyes. And it got to the point where, and he also only sold the restaurant for $2,500, which even in that time wasn't a lot of money for a restaurant.
I think he just took the first offer and was like, "Yep, fine, take it."
Yeah. That's so sad though, because all of that are clear symptoms of PTSD: drinking to self-medicate, gambling because you have terrible impulse control, the irritability, all of that. And so the fact that his pension was reduced because he was suffering from alcoholism, which was likely related to his PTSD,
They probably hadn't even fully decided what PTSD was back then.
They called it shell shock.
It was a fairly recent thing.
Yeah, it was the help for it now is lacking. I can't imagine post World War II. It's man up and get over it.
Yeah, no, there was no support for him, including at home, where his wife was pissed that he sold their family restaurant. And also, Anjette had started to beg family for money and use clothes for their kids because she couldn't feed and clothe them and support her husband. And now neither of them were really working. And it was not a good time for her.
Yeah, shit's getting bad.
I'm really feeling for her right now.
For now.
I know that will change. But right now I'm oh, honey, let me just give you a hug.
No. So in like December of 1951, his condition took a turn for the worse, and the doctors at the Macon Hospital really couldn't figure out what in the world was wrong with him. He was bleeding profusely from the nose and mouth, he was nauseous, and he was just like straight up not having a good time.
And I'm trying to remember what poison does that. That's where my mind goes. I'm like, I know there's one that makes you bleed like out of your...
We know like, where everything. Kelly is going very, very quickly.
Yeah, but Ben Lyles Jr. fell into a coma and died on January 25th, 1952. I think we all saw that one coming.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the doctors declared that his cause of death was encephalitis, which is another disease I never heard of, so I looked up, and it's inflammation of the brain caused by an infection or autoimmune response.
It's bad. Your brain swells and you die. It's not fun.
God, that sounds like the worst headache.
Oh,
but we're definitely sure it's not poison.
That's what the doctor said it was in 1952.
If you listen to our episode on Monday, my person gets poisoned, but then he dies in a car accident.
Yeah, what poison causes car accidents, Kelly?
Lots of them, no.
I am neither confirming nor denying
poison.
Whether that was his actual cause of death, but that is what the doctors declared in 1952.
Well, we don't want Jeanette to come at us for libel, saying she poisoned her husband.
Right.
libel, the worst crime of all.
Oh, yes.
Right, Sam?
Were the one who said there was going to be crime in that episode, Ellen, not me.
One time I was expecting crime in an episode. You know what the crime was? Libel. I was
pissed. Thought that Annie Oakley was an outlaw and not just like a sharpshooter performer.
I feel like that's a reasonable thing to assume.
Yeah.
She was good with guns.
She was like a very glam outlaw. She's like, I'm an outlaw, but with a paycheck and like a hairstylist.
Ellen really came into that episode with some like preconceived notions about who Annie Oakley was, and they were all wrong.
I learned a lot that episode.
That's good though. I mean, it's nice when you can teach people things about someone they think they know a lot about.
Fair.
Because if you learned things, Ellen, I'm sure other people did. Hopefully.
But I just had to deal with Ellen asking me every, like, 2 minutes of that episode where the crime was.
So is this where she murders someone? Because she's walking around with a gun. I know there's going to be a crime here. When does she shoot someone? Oh, she does it. What?
And about halfway through, I decided to play into it because I knew there was libel at the end. So I was just like, yeah, crime's coming.
It's coming, I promise.
Man, just I normally do not support gaslighting, but Sam, brava. Way to gaslight your co-host.
She deserved it.
I have not forgiven her. 10 episodes later.
Sam, watch out because after this, Ellen is doing some sword fighting lessons and I think she might be preparing for something. Exhibit A for premeditation.
Yeah, I'll show you. They will definitely play
this podcast at her trial when she kills me.
Yeah, right. Someone will come knocking on my door. We heard you have video of the beginning of this crime.
They're going to charge us with conspiracy because we were there and we were laughing about it.
But, and Jet, who was only 26, had 2 kids and was now widowed, moved back in with her parents, which, fair. And she started working in another local restaurant. She realized she really liked working in restaurants, and so she wanted to, like, get herself back to the point where she could, like, own and operate her own restaurant again.
Yeah.
And so she started working in this other restaurant, Bell House Restaurant, and she saved as much money as possible. Like, she really nickeled and dimed herself. She stayed living with her parents, and she was able to save up enough money by April 1955 to buy back Lyle's restaurant.
Good for her! Exciting.
That's great.
Yeah. While her husband sold it for $2,500, she bought it back for $12,000.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Ooh.
That sounds more accurate in price ranges for, you know, restaurants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She had been, like, she had firmly believed in her heart that her husband had stolen this restaurant from her, and so she was, like, very proud of herself for this, and she also renamed it In Jets because she was, like, screw him.
She probably, like, went to his grave and was like, ha, motherfucker!
She, like, threw a new menu down.
Yeah.
Honestly, she deserved it.
Yeah, I kind of agree.
I do, too.
I mean, I'm not mad at her entirely.
Like, yet.
She's a really fun character until, like, murder number 3, in my opinion.
Oh, okay.
But Anjette's served typical Southern food, and people again agreed that the main attraction was her friendliness and outgoing personality. And this place quickly became the most popular restaurant in town. Like, everyone was going to Anjette's.
Wow.
She was also known for being a headstrong woman who was known for stretching the appropriate limits of what was acceptable in small Southern towns.
So, just like a strong, independent woman then.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was pretty much a woman business owner who, like, was supporting herself.
Well, you know, yeah, that's too much.
It was the 1950s. They didn't like that.
She was a new woman.
But she had a very, like, impressive clientele. Businessmen, judges, attorneys, and civic leaders would often, like, gather in her restaurant. It was, like, a town meeting point.
Wow.
And she also started driving a flashy car. She always dressed in, like, the newest, most provocative styles, and she was incredibly flirtatious. Like, people were always gossiping about who she was seen, like, out with, the men she was probably dating. Like, we don't really know a lot about her dating life besides, like, the guys she marries, but, like, everyone was always talking about her dating life.
Well, yeah, if she's a pretty young, you know, like, independent owner. Woman.
Yeah, she's unattached. She's doing it for herself. Sisters are doing it for themselves. This is where we get sued.
Yep. Thanks.
It's also, for educational
provocative
purposes.
Outfits in the 50s, what? Is she, like, showing them some knee?
No, probably I don't shoulders. Even think that far. I'm going to go with, like, some ankle.
You can see that little bone on her wrist, and it's just like, she like, holds it out and flexes it, and everyone's
yeah,
like
when she gives when she brings you your check, she's like, look at my wrist.
That's a hot bone.
Oh yeah.
So the restaurant was kind of close to the local, like, private airport they had, so it was a cool place for the charter airline pilots from Capital Airways to hang out, which Capital Airways was an airline until 1984. Just fun fact that I was curious because I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, like, same. That doesn't sound, you know, like they're around anymore, and they're not.
No. Back before the oligarchy that we have now. Anyway.
But in late spring of 1955, Anjette started dating one of the pilots, a guy named Joel Neil Buddy Gabbert. And so her and Buddy, like, were kind of, like, hanging out for a couple months. And in 1955, he took her to Texas and New Mexico as, like, a little vacation. And while they were in Carlsbad, New Mexico, on June 24th, 1955, they eloped.
Aww.
Yeah. And
as one does in Mexico.
New Mexico?
New Mexico.
Either.
Any state. Both.
Any state.
Any state. Well, New Mexico's a state.
Yeah,
Mexico is not. I know that.
I got, like, really excited when I saw they got married in Carlsbad, because I live about, like, 20 minutes from a city named Carlsbad, and then I was like, oh, New Mexico. Different Carlsbad, apparently.
Wrong state.
Wait, is it Carlsbad or bed?
B-A-D.
Carl's a bad boy.
Oh, don't say that.
They named a whole city after him because he's so bad.
Stop.
Two whole cities,
stop,
actually.
Because
two
I know Carl.
Oh. I
know
that
about,
Carl,
I know.
Too, and he's a bad boy.
Not in that way. At least I don't want to think about him in that way.
Making Kelly feel weird about her friends.
Yeah, thanks for that.
But when they got back to Macon, Joe moved into the Donovan household, so he, like, moved in with her and her parents and her kids, which, you know, is a move, I guess.
I know. Well, I suppose because if he's a pilot, maybe he's probably not around all the time, so
true.
It probably just makes more sense for him to, you know, stay there when he is in town.
Like, he didn't actually move in. He moved his toothbrush in.
Yeah.
And he's
just
never,
like,
there.
I'm just going to leave my suitcase here.
Yeah.
That was a lot more logical than I went with it. I was just like, oh, Anjette was not having any of this.
She was like, I don't want to have to move again.
Especially since 4 months into their marriage, so, like, they got married in June. This was October. Joe started having, like, really bad wrist pains, and he went to the hospital for a minor wrist surgery. Mm-hmm. And then the day after he got home, he spiked a really high fever, developed a skin rash that spread over his entire body. And never recovered.
Tell me, what poison is that?
I don't know. Something, I'm sure.
Once again, doctors could not figure out what was wrong with him. And so they transferred him to a better equipped hospital in Dublin, Georgia, where he died on December 2nd, 1955.
Oh, no.
So within 5 months of getting married, he's dead.
Yeah.
So if I didn't know what we were doing here right now, I would think that maybe he got an infection after the wrist surgery and that, like, because, you know, you can get a rash when you get an infection. Oh, yeah. And maybe that's what killed him. So that one, I'm not entirely surprised that they were like, reasons. Yeah,
so doctors couldn't really figure out what was actually wrong with him. Like, it didn't really match any symptoms for anything. So they wanted to do an autopsy, and Anjette refused. Because she was like, oh, he wouldn't have wanted that. Like, it was against his beliefs, is what she said.
I'm going to say this right now. If I die and the cause is not super apparent, autopsy me. I don't care what anyone else says. It's not against my religion. It's not against my personal beliefs. Cut me the fuck open.
Especially if the only person saying that you don't want an autopsy is, like, the number one suspect for having murdered you.
Yeah, your wife at 5 months.
So they actually didn't listen to her because they don't actually need permission, like, sketchy death situations, but they didn't find anything because they didn't do any, like, drug testing on the body.
As they didn't do any blood work, I'm sure.
Yeah. But while he was in the hospital, like, kind of near the end, a nurse asked Anjette if her husband was insured, and she said yes, and his mother won't see a penny of it. I've seen to that.
Oh! Anjette!
Right?
Damn, what a girl. Bitch!
So we will find, as we go further in this, that she is not good at saying the quiet part quietly. Like, she says the quiet part out loud.
Like, yeah, the thing you're supposed to say in your head, she didn't have that.
Oh, wait, did I say that loud or did I think that? I meant to think that. You'll never catch me. What? What? You heard that? No, I said that in my head.
And, like, to add insult to injury on this one, within a few months of his death, Anjette changed her last name back from Gabbert to Lyles. She used his life insurance payout to buy a new car and a house. She, like, didn't even publicly grieve. She almost immediately started, like, shit-talking her dead husband and saying he was mean to her, and she didn't even know why she married him in the first place.
Wow.
And, like, within a few months of Buddy's death, she began dating another Capital Airways pilot who was actually his former boss, Bob Franks.
Oh my God. What a tangled web Jeanette is weaving. Jeanette. I keep calling her Jeanette. And Jeanette.
The boss should have known better, though.
You know, I'm just going to say, like, not victim blaming here, but, like, it's a little weird to date the widow of your former employee who died, like,
months later,
5 seconds ago.
Under suspicious circumstances.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, like, that's not quite kosher.
It's not a smart move.
No. Bob did not make good choices.
Clearly.
No one in this story is making good choices.
No one in the story is making good choices. Pretty soon after she bought her new house, though, her first mother-in-law, Julia Lyles, moved in with her. Julia was getting kind of older. She was widowed. She was lonely. She wanted to spend more time with her two granddaughters. But Julia and Jet didn't really love each other very much. Like, they got along as... No, they didn't get along. They were not friends.
She doesn't seem to get along with any of her mother-in-laws.
No.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to get along with her husbands.
Yeah, she really just doesn't. She gets along with the people that visit her restaurant, and that's about it.
If you pay her, she loves you.
Julia, her mother-in-law, also started spending a lot of time at the family restaurant that had, like, previously been her and her husband's family restaurant, and so she was, like, helping run it and, like, sticking her nose all up in Anjette's business.
Ooh. Yeah, I'm sure she didn't like that.
And at one point, Anjette started going through her mother-in-law's stuff and found a checkbook that revealed that her mother-in-law had a lot more money than she thought.
Oh, snap.
It's about to go south.
Yep. Yeah. We're all like, oh, we know where this is going now. Yeah. It's what Emily said. If you have money, she's nice to you.
I feel like we're watching, like, Real Housewives or anything, like, oh, she had more money than we thought. And we're all like, oh, damn.
Shit's about to get
crazy.
Yeah. So this was the point where Anjette started pestering her mother-in-law about making a will.
Oh, Jesus.
But Julia was, like, kind of superstitious, and so she kept refusing to do it.
Good for her.
But Anjette was known, I'm just going to like take a little sidetrack about just like fun facts about Anjette. She was a practicer of dark magic.
Shocker.
What? She was...
Does that really surprise you?
Well, I'm just like, of all this stuff she's doing, oh, by the way, she was also like a bad witch. It's just,
yeah, no, I was like, this is a weirder. Great Halloween episode.
Oh my God.
It's perfect.
She was super obsessed with magic and the occult. She's frequented fortune tellers and root doctors. I found out a root doctor is a traditional healer and conjurer that was very popular in the rural Black South.
I was going to ask. I was going to be like, what is a root doctor?
I had a feeling that no one else knew what that was. And she also, she dragged her friends and family along with her to these fortune tellers and root doctors all the time. And she also started learning how to cast her own spells.
Oh.
Ooh.
And she tried to get her maid, Carmen, and her mother-in-law to help her cast these spells and, like, perform these ceremonies, and they were both, like, not feeling it.
How do you ask someone that? Like, okay, especially her maid, like, that's your boss. Can you imagine your boss coming up to you and be like, so I know it's not, like, quite in your job description, but I'm trying to curse some bitch who gave me a dirty look the other day. Could you just, like, help me light
this chicken's head off?
Yeah, cut the chicken's head off. Can we just, I'm going to go and light the candles. If you just draw, like, a pentagram with the chicken blood, that would be fantastic.
Well, especially since isn't Georgia, like, one of the main states in the Bible Belt?
Yeah.
So yep. I can definitely see people being like, nah, like, why would we? Like, no.
Also, did you pick up my foot cream from the store today?
Kill that chicken. And here's my dry cleaning.
Hell of a to-do list.
So she also would, like, perform these rituals in the back of her restaurant a lot to her employees.
Weird. Oh,
that's, like,
that's even
a lot
better.
Of times found her talking to candle flames. And so we looked it up because the articles kept talking about how, like, some of them had seen her lighting a black candle, and I was like, what's the significance of a black candle? And apparently, according to, like, certain kinds of voodoo rituals, black candles are known to be used when you want someone to die. Hmm. So if you do your, like, ritual over a black candle, you're, like, wishing for someone's death.
Oh, I thought it was because it went with everything.
So, you know, or it summons, or it summons the Sanderson sisters.
Oh, God.
The black flame candle.
Well, you have to be a virgin for that. We
know she's not.
No shame. We just know it's a fact.
She has two daughters, we know.
Yep.
Two daughters, two husbands.
Mm-hmm. Two angry mother-in-laws.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in August of 1957, Julia Lyle started becoming very ill.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's going downhill.
She had to go to the hospital, and she stayed there for a very long time. But her doting daughter-in-law, Anjette, was by her side every day. She would bring Julia's favorite foods from the restaurant, and she fed her, and she brought her drinks all the time. Everyone was commenting on how devoted and caring of a daughter-in-law Anjette was.
You know what? Well, sometimes
that's sweet.
The worst circumstances really bring out the best in all of us.
You know, right? That's also how you keep poisoning someone. Because otherwise, you hear those stories where someone is like getting really sick at home, and then they go to the hospital, and then they get better, and then they go home, and then they get sick again, and you're like, yeah, you're being poisoned.
You know, I love. I'm trying to give her the benefit of the doubt.
Like, she's poisoning.
Well, yeah, because it seemed like her symptoms just kept getting worse and worse. She had nausea, she had edema, which is apparently a lot of swelling in, like, internal body tissue.
Yeah, it's gross.
I had to look up a lot of weird things for this.
She's probably on some watch list now, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's either going to become a doctor or a murderer. Let's watch.
So yeah, she was nauseous, she had edema, she was bleeding randomly.
Oh.
The doctors could not figure out what was wrong with her again. And she died on September 29th,
1957. Oh, man.
Well.
God, that's then, so... Just,
had,
like,
had she made a will?
So.
Oh!
Oh, this is going to be good.
About a week after her mother-in-law's death, Anjette produced a will claiming that it was her mother-in-law's that stated that her estate would be split up into 3/3. One would get left to her other son, like her still living son, Joseph. A third would go to Anjette, and the last third would go to Anjette's daughters, and Anjette would be the trustee of that money.
Of course.
Oh.
Till they're 18, or whatever.
No, they're nine. The older
no,
ones
I'm saying
nine
until they're 18.
Oh, yeah.
I love or when whatever she's like, legal I gotta make was. It believable. So we'll give one third to the other kid.
So when does she start trying to seduce the remaining son to get a hold of his portion of the will?
Right.
That would have been a fun twist to the story.
She just seems like arrogant enough to try that.
At the funeral, you yeah. see her, you know.
She's wearing, her sleeves are all the way up to her elbow. She's dressed like a total slut.
She's just all over the brother.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, this will was somehow verified. Like, a lawyer looked at it and was like, oh, yeah, that's definitely Julia Lyle's will. I'm like, we're good.
They probably
was
didn't
she
know
sleeping
any
with
better.
Him, too?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Maybe. Ellen has it figured out.
And then we hit the point where I no longer am having fun with this story because Marcia, the eldest daughter,
oh, no.
started to grow very ill in late winter 1958 when she was 9 years old.
Sam, thank you so much for joining us today. We're sorry you have to leave early. It's been great, though.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So pretty much one day, Marcia got a really bad stomach ache and started coughing. And so Anjette gave her a traditional remedy for this, which led to her vomiting and being hospitalized.
So what poison does that?
Arsenic? I don't know.
All of them?
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm like drain cleaner. Too much booze?
Isn't Ipecac a poison? I don't know if that's a poison.
No, Ipecac, I mean, I think you can OD on anything, but Ipecac makes you throw up to get something out of your system.
So, okay. So the traditional remedy theoretically could have been Ipecac, but it probably wasn't.
Yeah. So this was the point when people in town finally started growing suspicious of all these deaths around Injet.
Took a minute, but we're here now.
Yeah, we got there.
So Marcia got, like, really sick, and she was in the hospital. And she, like, started having these hallucinations that induced these, like, terrible terrors where she would scream and scratch at her skin and, like, said there were bugs crawling on her.
No.
And Injet, instead of, like, trying to comfort her young daughter, laughed.
Oh.
What a bitch.
She clearly cares about no one other than herself.
Yeah. At one point, she was starting to get better, and the doctors told Injet that she was, like, doing much better, and they thought she was going to recover. And within, like, a day or two of them telling her that, she ordered a coffin.
Oh!
That's not super suspicious.
Oh, my God.
No. She also, around the same time, started packing up her daughter's personal things from the hospital, claiming that she wouldn't be needing them anymore.
What?
And she even threw away all the flowers that were being sent to her, but kept the vases, saying that she'd take them to the cemetery.
The empty vases.
Mm-hmm.
She would take the empty vases to the cemetery.
I'm assuming she would refill them with flowers.
They already have flowers. Like, devil's advocate, it's so hard to judge how someone grieves, but when the doctors are telling you your kid's going to be fine, and you're like, okay, time to buy the coffin, time to dump out the flowers.
Creepy.
Nice knowing you, kid.
I actually buy a coffin, too.
Yeah, like
does the guy at the funeral home selling you the coffin not ask, like, who died?
Yeah. Or who is dying?
Like, oh, no one, but it's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's just always good to have one around, you know, just
in
case.
Child size, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Marcia unfortunately died after a very long stay in the hospital on April 4th, 1958. And people were admittedly really sketched out this time around, and they insisted on an autopsy.
Good.
And so this is when, like, things got funky. The coroner
right now is
when they letter. So someone sent the coroner an anonymous letter. Actually, no. Someone sent Julia Lyle, so, like, the mother-in-law's sister, an anonymous letter saying that they suspected foul play. The letter actually read, and this was, like, to Julia Lyle's sister, please come out once, she's getting the same dose as the others.
Oh.
And so the sister of the mother-in-law gave this note to the coroner, and the coroner was like, I'm going to do a tox screen.
Good. Finally.
Yeah, and he found lethal quantities of arsenic in her system.
There we go.
Kelly is so excited.
I was right.
And you might be wondering, what is this woman's motives for murdering her daughter?
Money?
And you would agree that they are stupid. So, she apparently used to yell at Anjette all the time. Or she used to yell at Marshall all the time, like, in public, like, in front of her employees at the restaurant. She would yell at her, call her a son of a bitch. She would insult her for looking like the Lyles family, like, her dad's side of the family.
Wow.
She would threaten and swear to kill her if she, like, did one thing that she didn't like. Like, she apparently thought her daughter was just really annoying.
Just that daughter?
Just that daughter.
Okay.
Oh my god. It sounds like she probably looked a lot like the husband in that side. It was this constant reminder of, like, oh, you're the product of me being with that guy that I totally murdered. Oh, did I say that part out loud?
Like, noticed how aggressive she was towards this child. And, like, commented on it.
This is why we need CPS. Like, it is never appropriate to call a child a son of a bitch, okay? Like,
especially when you're the mother.
Yeah,
the
bitch. Like,
yeah. That's like just calling yourself a bitch at that point.
Well, right. I mean, she is.
Yeah.
No arguments.
She's not wrong.
But, so, this autopsy found lethal quantities of arsenic, and Anjette was, like, trying her best here to play it off. She was, like, playing the role of the, like, super grieving mother. She was doing all the right things. And she even claimed that the arsenic ingestion was an accident during a game of doctor and nurse her daughter played. She even got her younger daughter, Carla, who, like, is six or something at this point, to tell everyone a story about how she and her sister would play doctor and that she, at one point, fed her aunt poison as, like, joke medicine.
Okay, so now we've got the child in the conspiracy to murder. Great. Yeah.
I didn't murder her. My 6-year-old did. Calm down.
Also, around this time, people heard her starting to, like, make comments about Carla, and, like, so people were, like, real sketched out at this point.
Don't do this to me, Sam. Don't do
Carla
this.
Is fine.
Oh, thank God. I'm like, stop.
Oh, we just lost the 9-year-old. I can't handle losing the 6-year-old, too.
She was making not okay comments about Carla, but, like, we get her before that.
Okay.
Oh, no, so we're pretty sure.
Like, I wish I could murder this one like the other one. Oh, out loud?
Oh my god, she was really so bad. Like, she did these black candle rituals in public. She was, like, telling... She predicted 3 of the 4 deaths, like, at the hospital for her second husband, her mother-in-law, and her daughter. She was, like, telling people she was pretty sure they were gonna die.
Right.
She's like, I'm psychic. No, you're a murderer.
Yeah. No, they're pretty sure that the anonymous letter was sent by one of her employees who had also talked to the maid, and the maid had, like, made comments about how they kept running out of ant poison.
Oh!
Oh,
as the
no!
poison supply gets lower, the people get sicker.
And Anjette just, like, played it off. She was like, oh, there was an ant infestation at the restaurant. And all the employees were like, there was no ant infestation at the restaurant.
Right, like, we never saw it.
How many boxes of poison does it take to, like, deal with an ant infestation also? I feel like that's something you might buy once a year.
Right?
I don't know how Georgia is with their ants, but come on.
The coroner, like, with this body, sends away some hair and samples and whatnot to, like, a better lab in Atlanta for tox screens, and they come back, like, riddled with arsenic. So at this point, they dig up the bodies of Ben F. Lyles Jr., Buddy Gabbert, and Julia Lyles, and they exhume all 3 of them, and all of them had arsenic.
That's a great or worst thing about arsenic, is you don't need blood to find it. You can find it, in hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they were all just, like, had stupid levels of arsenic in them. And so at this point, they searched Anjette's home, and they found several boxes of ant poison, which contained arsenic.
Of course.
They found her voodoo paraphernalia, which, like, this is the 1950s in Georgia, so that's not looking good. Because they found, like, a bunch of candles, ridden spells, potions, powders, and roots.
Alright.
I hope it was just carrots. She's had, like, her fridge full of carrots, and they're like, look, there are roots! That's super sus!
I hope so, too, now.
Right? Wouldn't that be great?
Why do you have ginger, bitch?
Yeah, And then on May 6, 1958, Anjette was arrested on 4 counts of murder.
Good.
And this case became an immediate media sensation. She was like a young, pretty woman. I mean, she like was barely, she was in her 30s at this point. She was blonde. She was gorgeous. Like, the media was all over this. And so when the trial started in the first week of October 1958, it attracted worldwide attention. There were huge crowds outside the courtroom. Everyone was trying to like get a peek at her. And she was actually only put on trial for the murder of her daughter, but the prosecution was allowed to talk about the other murders, which like doesn't usually happen. Usually you can only get tried for like the whatever you're getting tried for at that moment. Yep. But there's an exception to that rule if the evidence shows that there was motive or intent for the crime. So the evidence from her other crimes apparently showed intent and therefore was like admissible in this court.
That's really interesting.
Murder your daughter's father. Yeah, not too far of a stretch.
And her grandmother and her stepfather.
Well, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's like, how can you bring up other crimes as evidence if she hasn't been convicted for them? But let's all be, she totally did it. Like, I'm not mad about it. But yeah, that's really surprising that they were able to be like, BT Dubs, we all know. We collectively know she murdered these three other people. Let's all just get on the same page with that.
That's pretty much, yeah, they were just like, we all know she did this. Like, yeah. we're just gonna go for it. And the prosecution showed that the deaths were logically connected in 10 ways. So I'm going to list them for you because they get wilder as you go down the list.
Oh, great.
Each of the victims had a close relationship to Anjette. Each of the victims died of a unique cause, aka they all were arsenic poisoned. Each victim died as a result of multiple doses, which built up to a lethal level. So it was like a continued thing. Mm-hmm. Anjette was the only person in close personal attendance to all four victims at the time of their death. Anjette showed little to no grief over the deaths, like all four of them. She would, like, did a little bit of public grieving and like called it a day.
Right, like 2 days later, I'm done, guys.
Yeah. Anjette collected a substantial amount of money as the result of all four deaths. Each victim was lavishly buried by Anjette. Like, almost like she's a little guilty.
Overcompensating.
Yeah.
This is how sad people act, right? Right?
Look at all the vases I put on my daughter's grave.
Yeah. Oh, there's supposed to be flowers in them? Well, I didn't know that.
Also, all the victims were originally taken to the same hospital, which let Anjette stay with them all the time. And Anjette expressed intense dislike for each victim publicly before or after their deaths. Also, Anjette predicted the death of each of the victims except her first husband. So those are the 10 ways that they were all connected and the reasoning that the prosecution used to be able to talk about all of them in one trial.
Valid.
Yeah.
And also Anjette's defense was weak. Like, weak as fuck. Like, it wasn't even a defense.
Did she try to defend herself?
Yeah. She might as well have. Like, she didn't try and plead insanity. She didn't try and, like, point a finger at anyone else. Her entire defense was that she gave a personal statement, which was, like, not even under oath, because they weren't allowed to give under oath personal statements at that point in time yet. And so she gave an unoathed personal statement claiming that she loved each of the victims and promised that she didn't kill them.
But I love them. I pinky promise I didn't murder them.
The prosecution even showed that she made upwards of $50,000 from all of the combined deaths, which I did a calculation is about $475,000 today.
Good God.
That's a decent chunk of money.
Yeah. And her weak defense was not helped at all by the fact that she was like icy cold in person. She did not cry once during the trial. Like, doctors went over the details of her daughter's, like, very painful, slow death. Other people were, like, crying and talking about it on the stands, and she did not flinch.
Well, none of these people were paying her, so there was no reason for her to be nice.
Also, several people saw her doctoring drinks that she brought to Marcia and Julia while they were in the hospital.
Oh my God.
And this was before those like crystal light packets. So like stirring stuff in your drink was weird. Yeah. What is that? strawberry lemonade. Don't worry about it.
Oh, the newspaper started calling her the glamorous platinum-haired widow. No.
The glamorous what?
Glamorous platinum-haired widow.
Oh, platinum hair. Okay. I thought you said platinumed hair. I'm like, what is that? What does she have going on up there?
Platted, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Also, why do they have to make it about her appearance?
It's the sexism she mentioned.
More sexism. Talk about it's her the murderous 50s ability. In Georgia.
Yeah, she's just a bitch. Don't talk about how she's like this bombshell blonde.
Also, Murderpedia felt the need to tell me that this was the most publicized trial in Macon County in the 20th century, which I don't know if that's an impressive thing to be.
I mean, probably not.
It's a niche.
Well, it just was like so many qualifiers.
Right.
We're one of the best history podcasts in Iceland.
Yeah, we're up there too. Don't worry.
We are one of the best women's history podcasts based out of Minnesota with hosts named Kelly and Emily, who have been friends since 2009. So take that.
A couple weeks ago, we literally got an email. I don't even know who this email was from. It just said, congratulations, you're like the 218th most popular history podcast in Iceland.
Yeah, and I remember we got an email like that, like when we had first started, and I was like, thanks.
Go Iceland. Showing up for the ladies.
I was just like, there's 218 people in Iceland.
Dear Damn. Icelandic listeners, please don't leave. Just don't listen to them.
Shots
we
fired.
Still love you.
But yeah, so Injet was convicted and sentenced to death for her crimes. The jury only deliberated for a half hour.
Good. They were probably like, let's get some free food.
And I was going to say, let's go back. It took 5 minutes for the Chinese food to get there and then 25 minutes for them to eat it.
Like, she did it, yeah.
Yeah, right. We all know. We don't even have to deliberate.
Yeah.
But now for some fun sexism.
Yay.
Injet would have been the first white woman executed in Georgia, and the politicians just, like, flat out weren't having it.
Oh. Like, ever? She would have been the first white woman ever? Yeah. Wow.
And so she gets, like, three appeals or something like that for death penalty cases, and she used all three of them, and she had stronger defenses during her appeals. She tried to say that she became passionately religious and repented. That didn't work. She tried for an insanity defense and had a doctor like examine her, and the doctor was like, she's faking this.
Good job.
And then she tried to pin the blame for her first two husbands and her mother-in-law's death on her mother-in-law. She even like forged a note saying from her mother-in-law, like claiming that she had done it all. And then she tried to pin the blame for her daughter's death on her own mother.
Oh my god. Wow. See, I thought she was going to blame the 6-year-old again. No, this is some bad seed shit.
I'm just imagining like the note that said from the mother-in-law's note that says, I've killed those other people. It's like, hey, isn't that the exact same handwriting as the will?
Right. Well,
so actually, yeah, an expert did like look at the signatures on the will and her and the note that Anjet produced, and also found like something in Injet's desk that was just her practicing her mother-in-law's signature over and over again.
Burn that shit, bitch!
And girl, do like, better. Expert was like, "Oh no, all of this was forged."
I'm actually like
a late, but
I'm actually like embarrassed that she is a woman and being this stupid. Like, come on, yeah, be better, do better.
I was when I read that they found that, I was just like, I physically face.
Yeah, you're like, oh my god.
See, this is caught.
Yeah, don't write down your crimes.
The other murders in
people.
Georgia, they were smarter than this. My state represents.
Yeah, but so Governor Ernest Vandiver was not really wanting to kill a white woman in his state, and so he like stayed her execution for a little bit longer and appointed a sanity commission, which was 4 psychiatrists, a psychologist, and a medical doctor to examine Injet. And this team concluded that she was insane and psychotic and diagnosed her with chronic paranoid schizophrenia.
So basically he sent them in and were like, just diagnose her with something. We're not going to kill her. Just diagnose her something.
Well, and just because you struggle with a mental illness does not mean you qualify for insanity, because that is, like, in the criminal justice system, it's being able to determine the difference between right and wrong.
Right.
And with how much effort she clearly put into each of these murders, which she continued to commit with calculated precision, right, I think she fucking knew what she was doing. It's not like she broke and she's like, and I, then I saw the blood on my hands and then I knew they were dead. Like, no! Asshole!
Nice Chicago reference.
Yes.
This, like, Sanity Commission started claiming that she was, like, having hallucinations, which, like, included seeing flying angels and, like, shit like that in the room. And I was just like, you know, they were given a job and they did it.
Right. They were clearly paid to do this and they did it. So good job.
And yet they're not angels. I'm telling you that right now, honey.
Also, at one point while she was in prison, she bribed a jail official to bring her ant poison. And when the jail found this out, they put her in solitary confinement.
What?
Are you kidding? This bitch will not stop.
She was like, I really don't like my cellmate, guys.
Try
She's gotta go.
Else. God. Yeah.
Make a shiv like everyone else.
God. So privileged.
Yeah, but the Board of Pardons and Paroles took this diagnosis and decided to commute her death sentence and send her to a mental hospital for the rest of her life.
Jesus Christ, don't do that.
So she was sent
to the
state.
There's so much more lax at mental health hospitals.
Yeah, it was also a 1950s mental health hospital, so like...
Yeah, maybe that is better. Better.
She was sent to the state hospital for the insane in Midgeville, Georgia, and she stayed there until her death. While she was there, though, she became well known in the hospital for being a fortune teller, and she continued practicing her magic.
Yeah, what happened to that religious conversion she tried with her first appeal? Clearly it didn't stick.
Yeah,
did she
predict
any more deaths?
She ended up dying of heart failure in the mental hospital at age 52 on December 4th, 1977. And you guys, she was buried in the same plot as her first husband and her daughter.
Shut the fuck up right now.
Who approved that?
And that's the end of my story.
Four people have died, and that is the thing that disgusts me the most, I think. Like, it's all horrible, but...
That's
to
probably second.
Bury,
that's the second most.
To...
Murdering your daughter is the first.
Bury the murderer with their murder victims, especially when one is a child.
Yeah, put her in an unmarked grave behind the mental hospital.
Yeah, what they've got a cemetery. Throw her out to sea. I don't care. That is so deplorable.
Who's a witch? Burn her on a pyre.
Can we start a petition to move Anjette? Because that's wretched.
So I listened to an episode of My Favorite Murder where they talked about her, and it was actually like their live show when they were in Atlanta. And at one point they were like, hey, we know this graveyard's like a 45-minute drive from this convention center. Like, we're not saying people should go like defile this grave, but like, we're not saying
but
people
don't,
shouldn't.
Don't, because the daughter and the husband are buried.
Yeah. Maybe that was the only way they could like assure that no one was going to mess up Anjette's grave. Which, like...
Well, I guess... I'm assuming they're not married in the same actual, like, plot. I'm assuming it's, like, they're next to each other.
They're, like, next to each other.
Okay.
So, I guess you could defile her grave.
Oh, see, I was imagining, like,
grave.
A Jenga situation. Like, they're all just stacked up on top of each other.
I think we should put a vase.
An empty vase.
An empty vase. Leave
like
an empty
upside
vase.
Down.
Yes. With a chicken foot.
Okay. So yeah, that's Anjette Donovitt Lyles.
Wow.
It was a weirdly fun research to do, I'm not gonna lie.
Well, she's so nuts because, like, you know, when you hear about women killers, you know, a lot of times there's that financial motivation or it's jealousy and poison, and this had all that. Oh, by the way, she's also practicing dark magic, like, and just
so
being as crazy as possible.
I started this research and then I called Ellen and I was like, you know, murder is bumming me out. I'm gonna find like a female ghost in Georgia or something. And Ellen was like, okay. And then I was in the middle of an article and so I was like, I'll finish the article. And then they got to the Black Magic Park and I was like, oh, I guess I'm gonna finish this research.
Right? You're like, never mind.
Just the side note. Also, she was a witch. He's like, okay, that convinced me.
Yeah.
This is kooky.
Man, and there's nothing wrong with witchcraft, but I don't feel like what she was doing would qualify as, like, proper witchcraft. No, it was more like she was just being a crazy bitch.
She was just sitting in the back room with a candle going, I'm going to kill this person. I'm going to kill this person. I'm going to kill this
person. Well, you know, the other thing is, too, I almost wonder if it was a cover because, like, she's doing all these spells and stuff, and it's putting distance between her and the victims because she had to physically poison these people. There was, like, an actual event that needed to happen for these people to be poisoned.
It's not arsenic. It's crystal light. It's sugar. What are you talking about?
But then there's this performative aspect because even if people suspect her, oh, she killed them with witchcraft. Like, you can't convict someone for lighting a black candle and then someone ends up dead. So part of me feels like it was but she was a white woman, which is literally the only reason she got out of prison. And she was so nice. She gave the best hugs.
Like, that would creep me out after the fact. I guess at least she wasn't, like, a strangler, but I'd still be like, ugh.
I totally thought she was going to be a strangler. When you said hugs around the neck, I was like,
Yeah, no, that was a all-over-the-place tale. Like, I was looking for female murderers, and, like, according to Murderpedia, there's only, like, 3 women in Georgia who have ever murdered more than one person. And so the other one was, like, way too recent. And I was like, I don't want to do someone who could potentially still be alive.
Right? Yeah. You're like, I don't need that shit.
And, like, the victims, families, and everyone.
No. And so I, like, looked at this one and I was like, and the, like, Murderpedia, like, little tag was just number of victims and, like, weight. And it was, like, 4 victims, poisoning. And I was like, oh, this is going to be a boring one. Like, it's just going to, like, I was just, like, not here for it, but I, like, started the article and I was like, nope, this took some turns.
Well, thank you for telling us about Anjette, who I keep wanting to call Anjanette. I don't know why.
That's fair. It's a, like, weird name.
Yeah, you know what?
I don't know if it was, like, normaler back then.
She's a bitch. I don't need to say her name properly. Now, we are also covering a hometown murder case, not a serial killer, but a really twisty tale that has more questions than answers. I have actually titled our story today, To Be Seen and Not Heard.
Which is funny, because that's like the opposite of Anjanette.
Yeah.
Who just said everything.
Yeah. She had no inner monologue. She was soliloquying out the ass.
Honestly, maybe the black candle talking was just like, she knew that she was going to say it.
Yeah.
Right? She's like, this way I can at least, candle. You know, yeah, I'm saying it to a candle, not to a real person.
Yeah, it's fine. That was her way of journaling.
Maybe I should try that.
I journal by calling Ellen and saying it to her.
That's funny.
So we're going to be traveling back to 1909, St. Paul, Minnesota. It's 4 a.m. on May 13th. A 16-year-old newspaper boy, Isidore Abrahamson, is hard at work delivering that day's news to the Seven Corners neighborhood residents. Suddenly, screams calling for help shatter the early morning silence. Isidore follows the desperate cries to the 2-story Arbogast home. The stench of smoke fills the air, and the boy finds 2 young women standing on the front steps. Sisters Ida and Minnie Arbogast stand in their nightgowns, sobbing and screaming. Ida cries, "My poor papa! Won't somebody please help my poor papa!" in that exact voice.
Of course.
Isidore runs into the house where he finds the last 2 of the Arbogast daughters, Louise and Flora, overcome with grief. You know, those hysterical women.
Of course.
Isidore rushes up the stairs, following the smell of smoke and gasoline, passing Mrs. Arbogast, who has burns on her body on the stairs. The smell came from Mr. and Mrs. Arbogast's room. As Isidore looks inside, he is met with the horrific sight of Mr. Louis Arbogast, a 51-year-old butcher, lying on his bed, engulfed in flames.
15-year-old butcher would be way more impressive.
I do have to say, Isidore sounds like a female name to me. So, like,
that would be Isadora.
I don't care.
Dora for short. Dottie in like any other time.
51-year-old butcher.
Yep, engulfed in flames.
Perfectly good chance to butcher the butcher. And they went with burning.
God. But wait, there's more. So I can't imagine how a 16-year-old me would react to a man on fire. But to Isidore's credit, because 16-year-olds were like yesteryear's 30-year-olds, he immediately grabs a blanket to try and smother the flames. Another man drawn in by the cries for help rushes into the room to help. It's Henry Spangenberg.
I'm sorry, but that is definitely a Minnesotan name.
Spangenberg.
That is 100% Scandinavian.
And he is the fiancé of the eldest Arbogast daughter, Louise, who, as we remember, is like freaking out
in the house. Okay, she was one of the...
I'd be freaking out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
probably be like fainted somewhere.
Is it a Minnesotan name, though, because the devil chose it?
Yes.
Yes.
The devil is also Scandinavian because that's where Satan's sex island came from. From the Netherlands.
The Scandinavian witches.
Huh. Yes. So they managed to put the fire out in the bedroom, but fresh smoke is still billowing through the home. Isidore finds at the bottom of the back stairs, because apparently this is a sitcom house with like two sets of stairs, there is a roll of fabric and feathers, which is also on fire. The fire from this bundle begins to spread to the walls, and because Isidore is clearly a master of crisis, he quickly tosses the flaming pile out the back door and begins to put out the flames that threaten the rest of the house. Isidore is here for it.
Isidore in a crisis.
Yeah.
Why is the 16-year-old newspaper boy?
May we all be Isidore in a crisis, or have an Isidore in our crisis.
He's clearly going to grow up to be like Batman.
You know, he's also probably like the fire police chief or something, because 16-year-olds were adults back, like considered adults back then.
Oh yeah, he was like the newspaper boy in the morning, and then in the afternoon he'd go to the fire department, and like in the early evening he'd like solve crime.
Yeah, of course.
And then
he'd sleep for 2 hours and start all over again.
Well, he liked delivering newspaper early in the morning because it was his like quiet me time away from the wife and his 12 children. So when firefighters arrive to help, they are able to take a closer look at the body of Louis Arbogast, and they are shocked by what they see. His naked body is laying face down crosswise on the bed. So like making a T with the bed. Feathers from the pillows are scattered across him, covered in blood. And the walls and bedsheet are also spattered and soaked in blood. Likely from the back of Lewis's head, which has been caved in.
Oh, they did butcher the butcher.
Hardcore murder.
They butchered the butcher.
Some serious anger.
Despite having his skull bashed in, serious blood loss, and having been set on fire, this poor man was still alive when the firefighters got there.
Holy shit.
So Louis is rushed.
This guy's tougher than Isidore.
I know.
But like, I want him to be dead just because that can't feel good.
No, so, I feel like there's no recovering from that.
I will grant mercy because he dies. he gets sent to the hospital, but succumbs to his injuries, and he dies.
Yeah.
Oofta, who done it?
So, who killed Louis Arbogast, and what series of events led to such a brutal attack on this unassuming local butcher? In this twisted tale, answers only seem to breed more questions, and not everything, or everyone, is as they appear.
First, it's going to be the wife, right? It's always the wife.
Well, maybe.
No, it's always the husband, but you know.
He did it to himself.
So first, let's talk about the Arbogast family. Louis was a German immigrant and a successful butcher in the city of St. Paul. So successful, in fact, that he was estimated to be worth over $200,000, which today is almost $6 million.
That's a lot of meat. That's before the vegans and vegetarians ruined the meat industry.
Mm-hmm. So Louis and his wife, Mrs. Mina Arbogast, had 5 lovely daughters. Louise was 23, Ida, 22, Emma, 19, Minnie, 18, and Flora, 16. Just a heads up, we're not really going to talk about Emma because just like any respectable 19-year-old, she had already gotten married and was living with her husband at the time of the murder.
Her husband was Isidore.
Oh, she married young. No. I want a cradle robber. Right. I want to point out that I couldn't find Mrs. Arbogast's name in any publications, and we got her name from another podcast, actually.
If you're really interested in Minnesota true crime, listen to Where Blood Runs Cold. It's by the same guy that does Most Notorious, but he's from Minnesota, so he has like a Minnesota-specific true crime podcast, and it's amazing. Great.
I feel like there's another true crime podcast that's like out of Minnesota.
Wine and Crime is based out of Minnesota, but they don't just cover Minnesota.
Yeah.
What is it about Minnesota?
It's the devil.
It is, yeah.
We established this.
No, it's because we're next to Wisconsin, where all the murderers come from, and so we're just like, we're just going to talk about him.
That's where Ellen is right now.
Listen, I know. Just because Jeffrey Dahmer's from here doesn't mean we're all cannibals.
Ed Gein. There's like six. I'm not even joking.
So I am currently in California, which like per capita has the most serial killers of any state.
Mm-hmm. The Midwest is getting bad, though. I was listening to this thing, and it was talking about how in the 70s, like, California was really bad because that's where all these people were going and, like, kind of living these, like, free transient lifestyles. And these serial killers were just running wild and having the time of their lives. And now the Midwest, everywhere is struggling with an opioid crisis, but it's really bad in the Midwest. And so serial killers are taking advantage of that. And I think it's like Ohio is really bad. Stay out of Ohio, kids.
Right. Anyways, back to the
I will protect the opioid addicts in Ohio with my sword.
Yes. Ohio? Oh, no.
So the eldest Arbogast, Luis, had a knack for numbers and helped her father at the butcher shop as the cashier and bookkeeper. The two were extremely close and spent every day together. Luis is described her, so she described herself as the favorite daughter.
Luis described Luis. It's hard because I think she was named after her father. So Luis Arbogast is the father. Luis is the eldest daughter.
So the dad clearly had a favorite, and that was his obviously. Eldest daughter.
Yes.
In fact, a close family friend would describe how Luis would always give Luis more spending money than she needed, and that Luis acted more as the family matriarch than her own mother did.
Well, her own mother doesn't even have a name in any publications.
Apparently.
So. Yeah.
So back to the scene of the crime. When police investigate the scene, they find two empty gasoline canisters. Gasoline canisters.
Yeah.
This is what I was about to say. In Lewis's bedroom, along with a trail of bloody footprints that lead to the basement, where they find a bloody axe wrapped in cloth and newspapers.
Doesn't everyone have one of those in their basement?
I mean, I do.
Do I need to get rid of mine?
So if you're thinking that someone snuck in, carrying two cans of gasoline, an axe, and some matches, hats off to you for being so enterprising and creative, but you're wrong. All of the doors and windows in the house were locked. The family also had a guard dog in the backyard who didn't bark, so clearly the killer was inside the house.
The call's coming from inside the house.
Right. The prospect of a woman committing such a brutal crime was absolutely mind-blowing to 1909 society. Like, literally, people, like, passed out at the thought of it. In fact,
they passed out at anything back then.
That's what I was surprised. None of the daughters were like passed out. That was very.
Did they have a fainting couch at least?
In every room. So, yeah. They had to have one in every room because you never know where you're going to be exacerbated.
So, in fact, just a few years earlier, in 1892, infamous parent killer Lizzie Borden had just gotten off scot-free. Largely in part due to her gender.
Despite being sketch as hell.
When investigators questioned the five women, things didn't quite add up.
So this is what Mrs. Mina Arbogast says happened. Mrs. Mina Arbogast claimed that she was in the bathroom when her husband was attacked and set on fire. What a horrible time to be in the bathroom. Or the best time.
Because you also didn't get murdered then. Yeah.
Well, you know, you have a very convenient place to shit from, like, shock.
You know, like the roundhouse riddle where it's like, oh, there's a guy murdered in a roundhouse, and then someone's like, oh, I was in the corner sleeping up.
And then they're like, it's a roundhouse guy.
Yeah.
So she didn't even know what had happened until she heard one of her daughters screaming. Then she ran to her husband, Lewis, and tried to pull him from the blaze, which is what she said caused her to have all these burns on her body. Because she did. She was horribly burned. Aww. And it sounds like the bathroom was right across the hall, rather than in the bedroom, like a master suite situation, which is why she might not be aware of what's happening in the room. But that still sounds kind of bonkers to me. Like, how do you not hear your husband being attacked with an axe and then doused in two canisters of gasoline and set on fire until one of your daughters starts screaming? And this was before.
I'm trying to think because my bathroom's across the hall from my bedroom, and I'm like.
But, like, how long was she in that bathroom?
I know. I'm like, what are you doing? Curling your hair at 4 a.m?
Well, and this is before cell phones. So it's not like she was just like really engrossed in Facebook or Candy Crush where she's just like, I don't even know what's happening because I'm trying to match these fucking candies over here.
Well, because that's what I'm like thinking about is I'm like, you got to remember, it's like 3:30, 3 o'clock in the morning when this is going down. So, like, yeah, it's not like she's curling her hair, you know, getting ready for bed.
It was a really intense deuce. Do you ever get those where like everything kind of goes white?
Did women read at this point?
Yeah, right? Probably not.
I would hope she's educated. Her husband's worth $6 million.
I mean, clearly their oldest daughter is. Yeah. So.
I
heard the thunk of my husband's skull breaking. I'd be a little concerned.
I feel like that's got to be as loud as your daughter yelling.
Yeah.
You know, clearly, they must have had like a gramophone in the bathroom. She's pumping out some old time
hello,
tunes.
My baby. Yeah. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime
gal.
Sounds
like a popping bathroom.
Yeah, right? Clearly, there was a fainting couch in there, too.
Oh, yeah.
She was just taking a nap. She didn't want to admit it.
So the other odd thing about Mrs. Arbogast's story is that despite having burns, she was dressed in a clean nightgown, indicating that she had found the wherewithal to change clothes while her husband was burning alive.
Maybe she went to shock?
Maybe.
I feel like you don't change your clothes when you're in shock.
No, you just kind of stand there.
I feel like you do a lot of weird shit when you're in shock. Anytime someone does something weird in a murder podcast, I'm always just like, they were in shock. Like, there's explanation here.
I mean, I guess we don't know how people react to grief. Maybe you change your outfits.
It would depend on, like, the exact timeline. Like, while the husband's still on fire, that's sketch. If it's, like, after and there's, like, the police there and they're all like, oh my god, there's a burned lady and a burned man. It's like, I can see that.
Yeah. Investigators did locate the burned and bloodied nightgown that she had changed out of, and the undergarments were found in the bathtub.
So clearly she went back to the bathroom.
Yes.
To change.
I mean, it's a nice place. They have a gramophone in there.
Right? Yeah.
Like, what kind of bloodied are we talking? Is this, like, blood splatter from smacking him in the head, or?
Well, I wonder if you could even tell.
It was also burned. You probably couldn't tell.
Well, there's some red, and there's some black, and none of this looks good.
Right. It was her time of the month. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Honestly, she probably could have said that and been like, well,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, don't make me talk about it. And there are all these like male investigators who are like, whoa, no, say no more. I don't want to hear about that.
All right. So now we're on to Flora's story, the youngest Arbogast. So when questioned by police, 16-year-old Flora said that she was awakened in the bedroom she shared with her eldest sister, Louise, by the sound of her mother's screams. When she ran to their bedroom, she found the bed engulfed in flames. On the bed was Louise's body, but also her mother, who was lying next to him. Flora pulled her mother off the bed, but was unable to rescue her father. The screams woke up the three other sisters, who then, understandably, lost their shit.
Unfortunately, not in the bathroom, though.
After giving their initial statements to police, the Arbogast women stopped talking. They refused to talk to the police, reporters, neighbors, friends, anyone, even stranger. Yeah. Shortly after the murder, eagle-eyed reporters spotted the family's stable boy shredding the bloody mattress that Louis had been killed on. Now I know. Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun. So,
like, clearly, something happened and they didn't bother getting their story straight before anyone showed up, which was just, like, stupid.
No. Yeah.
Like, the first thing you do is you gotta be like, okay, this is what happened. And you gotta agree on
Mom
what happened.
Mom was in the bathroom.
Yep. Playing Candy
one
Crush.
One of the girls screamed. That's what happened.
I think Isidore came in too early. They didn't expect an Isidore.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Like, shit.
Man, this spunky 16-year-old is really fucking up our murder plot.
Right? Now, I know what you're thinking. Oh, God, they're destroying the evidence. Well, kind of. You see, this is 1909, and the investigators weren't the super sleuths that we have today. That's why they hadn't even collected the mattress. So it was, in fact, totally within the right of the family to trash the mattress. Because it wasn't collected as evidence. What else? What would
1909 investigators even do with it? They can't test the DNA.
Right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, well, we know he was killed on this because it's covered in blood and burns. That's kind of all we need to know.
Have you seen that John Mulaney bit?
That's exactly what I'm thinking of.
Go for
Detective,
it,
Detective, there's a pool of the victim's blood, of the killer's blood here. Ah, gross.
Mop it up. Back to my hunch.
That's great.
Oh my God.
So also, if the police aren't taking this bloody, you know, burnt mattress off your hands, what are you going to do with it? Hang it in the foyer as a conversation piece? Whether or not it was reasonable for the Arbogast to destroy the mattress, it only fed the fire of rumors growing around the family.
Almost as big as the fire that killed Lewis.
Additionally, when Lewis's brother is interviewed by reporters, he said that he doesn't want to get involved, but he knows that the murder couldn't have been committed by anyone outside of the house.
What a, like, shady thing to say. Like, hey, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to say anything, but I will say it was one of those bitches over there.
Right.
I'm just saying.
That's like when you're with your girlfriends, one of them's like, you didn't hear this from me.
Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. You didn't hear this from me.
Every single one of my nieces is suspect.
Yeah, exactly. So 2 days after the murder, Luis, the eldest, had a nervous breakdown and checked herself into a hospital for a rest cure, which is basically when you just chill in the hospital for a bit. But this is like the nice type of like mental hospital for people that can afford it, not the one where they're like, you're just going to go sit in shit all day.
You get a lobotomy. Also, like, you get a lobotomy.
Like, you're in a spa and they invent cornflakes for you.
Probably. Yeah,
to keep you from masturbating, of course.
They're getting treated for hysteria with vibrators, right, which they had just invented.
So this caught the reporters' attention and they began to put Luis under a microscope. It turned out that Luis was not a stranger to nervous breakdowns and stints in the sanitarium. Just 2 months earlier, she had checked into the hospital for a breakdown, and the psychiatrist who treated her, called an alienist at the time, which is great, seemed more than happy to talk to reporters and tell them how he had diagnosed her as hopelessly insane, and at the time of her release, she had not been cured.
Fun. Oh, what are you taking medication for?
Why is hopelessly insane a diagnosis?
Yeah.
So many questions.
So the family doctor of the Arbogast had also diagnosed Luis with a severe case of melancholia with suicidal tendencies, which today we call depression. Doctors warned the family that unless Luis was permanently committed, she would most likely kill herself or someone else. I want to take a moment to point out that those who suffer from mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence rather than perpetrators. True story.
Yeah. Kelly's going to graduate school to be a psychologist. I always screw it up. Psychologist. Oh. So she can basically read all of our brains right now, and she is an expert on that topic.
Oh, I don't want to know.
So while there's still stigma surrounding mental illness today, it was even worse back in 1909, and the treatments were ineffective at best and torturous at worst, like Emily mentioned. Lobotomies.
Yay.
Reporters ate up the narrative of the beautiful but broken psychotic Luis. Of course, they had to throw beautiful in there.
Oh, yeah.
And it didn't help.
Is she engaged?
Yeah,
she is.
I know. I like that her fiance isn't stepping up and being like, hey, guys.
I just haven't heard about him since he like showed up at the crime scene. I'm like, where is he?
Yeah, right. So there's all this speculation about Luis, and it didn't help because even her own mother sold her out. While still recovering in the hospital from her burns, Mrs. Arbogast said that Luis suffered from hallucinations and paranoia, believing someone was trying to hurt her. Despite doctors' warnings the family about Luis's behavior, it was Luis who insisted that she be released from the hospital 2 months prior and that she come home. In hindsight, that sounds like a bad idea. But Luis was his favorite daughter, and her wicked math skills were extremely valuable to the family business.
Cool. Gotta love that profit over people mentality.
Oh yeah. Capitalism at its best. So suspicion...
What is math, if not another form of insanity?
When a woman is doing it, she's a witch.
That's fucking magic.
That's actually why she was committed, because they're like, I'm sorry, you know what 2 + 2 is? Witch?
The number of ways I would be convicted of being a witch if I was back in the day.
Oh, that's
the goal.
There are actually stories of people being, women in particularly, being committed to mental hospitals for reading.
Yeah. It's so funny. I'm like, I would have been so screwed.
Yeah, we're all that's certifiable.
Handmaid's Tale bullshit right there.
Right. Oh, yeah. And it was always like some husband who was just like, I don't want to deal with you anymore. Yeah, this is easier than a divorce. So suspicion around Louise only mounted when she was released from the hospital to attend her father's funeral on May 16th. Nosy onlookers were quick to point out that Louise refused to look at her father's body in the casket, which I'm like,
why would you have an open casket? The guy burned.
His head was bashed in and he was burnt. I wouldn't want to look at him either. Why do you want to remember him that way?
Close that thing, guys.
I know. God. And despite all of the murmurs, police didn't really have anything to go on until they get a break from Mrs. Mina Arbogast herself. So while interrogating her in the hospital, because she's still recovering from her burn, she is not doing good, Mrs. Arbogast cracks and tells them what really happened that fateful day. Dun, dun, dun. It was Isidore the whole time.
Yeah, right? That's why he got there so fast.
He just wanted to be a hero. He was sick of delivering the newspapers and not getting credit. His 12 children were all laughing at him.
Start arsons. Yes.
He was sick of being the town newspaper boy, fire chief, and police chief all at the same time.
Right.
He was sick of delivering the news. He wanted to be the news.
He's like, I need to do something so great that they'll just pay me a bunch of money and I never need to work again.
Isidore, how you disappoint us. So according to Mrs. Arbogast, she was just getting done with her epic and all-consuming Candy Crush game in the bathroom, or her BM, whatever she was doing in there, when she went to the bedroom to find a crazed Louise standing over Mr. Arbogast and the flaming bed with a bloody axe at her feet. It's the ghost of Louise! Oh,
well,
no.
Sound good.
Is everything okay?
I don't know.
For a second, I thought that was like in my house, and I'm like, what?
Why do things always fall when we talk about creepy shit? I hate it.
We'll see what our roommates have to say later.
Yeah, who broke something? Oh, yeah. If you have a cat, it was probably the cat.
Yeah, it could be the cat.
One time, Kelly's black pug ran in here, like busted through the door while I was talking about death. And I was like, death is so cute and tiny, because there's just this little black shadow like coming at me, and it scared the hell out of me.
Because I saw my dog coming.
Isn't a black dog
like
a harbinger of death?
Yes.
I don't think mine is.
She's your baby.
I don't think a black pug would be a harbinger of death.
Man, bring it on, Reaper, because that's cute.
Yeah, right. Like, give me all the hugs.
Yep.
All right.
What if Sirius Black just turned into a pug?
That would be cute.
So, understandably freaking out, Mrs. Arbogast started screaming and tried to put the fire out, which is how she got her burns. In an effort to protect Louise, they began to poorly dispose of the evidence. Like, where should we put this bloody axe? I know the basement. No one ever goes down there. Like, who else has an axe in their basement? No one. Where should we put the gas canisters? Just leave them in the bedroom. It's fine. It's a conversation piece. It's rustic. However, Mrs. Arbogast's story kept changing, like, constantly, and she refused to make direct statements for quite some time, making her unreliable at best, and at worst, she had a motive. The police discovered that Lewis's relationship with his favorite daughter, Louise, may have been more than it appeared.
No! Yep. No!
We're getting super gross. Allegedly, Lewis was going to leave his wife and follow Louise and her fiance to Alaska. Or even, Lewis was going to take Louise to Alaska and leave the fiance and everyone else behind.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
While no one outright...
No, I'm sitting on the story.
Yeah. That poor guy is just getting screwed left and right.
Brief one-line trigger warning.
Yes.
Honestly, I was betting that it was going to be Mina, but now I'm leaning towards...
Luis?
Right, Luis.
I'm still leaning towards Nina.
I'm really curious to see where
it's
we
be
all...
one of the other daughters.
I'm really curious to see where we all land at the end of this, because even like through all this research, I'm like, I don't know. Like, everyone kind of wants this guy dead.
It's going to be Emma, that daughter who's already married, boob dad, and we're not talking
about
it all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. She cleverly removed herself from the story so she wouldn't be a suspect.
Exactly.
Yeah. She was staying that night at her parents' house, but then when shit went down, she just left and no one even noticed because she doesn't live there.
Yeah. So, yeah, quick one-line trigger warning for sexual assault and incest. While no one outright said it, there were rumors and even the implication that Lewis may have been raping his daughter. Even the newspapers tiptoed around the issue the way that only writers in 1909 could, where it's like everyone's reading between the lines. It's like they're saying it without saying it. Now, let's be clear. What the newspapers were intimating wasn't that Lewis was a sexual predator, but rather that there was some like tawdry affair that created this love triangle within the family.
Oh my God.
But let's be even clearer. That's incestual rape and not okay. This isn't like some tawdry love affair. This is a father potentially assaulting his daughter.
Right.
Yeah, it's so not gross. It's not an affair if you're grooming your child who's like 30 years younger than you and your child.
Yeah. And we're not here to slander a murder victim because he is a murder victim, but it really makes you wonder. Lewis was deeply attached to Louise and had her spend every day with him. Abuse could also explain why Louise was struggling with severe mental illness, worried that someone was going to hurt her. She was turning on herself, was potentially a threat to others.
I mean, definitely. It sounds like definitely there was at least some grooming going on, even if it wasn't full-on assault or anything.
Whether it was a jealous or hopefully enraged Mina Arbogast taking revenge, or an angry and unstable Louise ending years of abuse, or even a familial conspiracy to prevent Louis from leaving the family destitute and like peacing out to Alaska, it seemed everyone had a motive to kill Louis Arbogast.
You say everyone, but we've only covered two people.
Yeah, aren't there like three more daughters?
Yeah.
In the house?
They also act a little sus.
So police, getting desperate, trying to get one of these women to crack, had Louise visit her mother in the hospital. The two had a heated conversation in a mix of English and German, during which Mina cried, "Louise, it is either you or me. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. You were outside father's door when I came from the bathroom. You must tell the truth."
Please tell me the police brought at least one German speaker with them.
Probs not.
That would require planning and forethought.
Yeah.
So Louise gave nothing away. I'm also suspicious of the fact that they had the conversation in both German, which the officers couldn't understand, and English. I'm not the only one. Newspapers and amateur sleuths latched onto this, suspecting that Mina and Louise were having two conversations, one that was confidential and one that was performative for the watchful authorities. Probs.
That's what I would do.
Like, right? I'm just imagining them, like, in German being like, okay, here's the plan. Louise, you did it! Okay, was that convincing enough? Now start crying.
No, see, they probably said, like, one not damning thing in German to make sure the police couldn't understand them. And then, yeah, they had the two separate conversations. Yeah. So, not sure who was really responsible. The police charged both Mina and Louise Arbogast with first-degree murder. With Mina's trial beginning at the end of October 1909, what the cops lacked in investigative ability, they made up for in judicial speed. Her trial lasted for 2 weeks. The jury asked the judge if Mina could be found guilty of a lesser charge of accidental homicide, to which the judge replied, nope.
Nope.
So she was found not guilty on November 4th, 1909. An article about the acquittal that was published in the Los Angeles Herald, this made national news, ended by saying, "Louise Arbogast's eldest daughter is under indictment of the same charge as that preferred against her mother and will be tried in a week or two."
But Louise's trial never came.
Oh, no.
Because the prosecution's evidence against Mina was also the exact same shit that they had on Louise, because they have nothing but like, well, we think maybe this happened. They weren't confident that they could get a conviction, and all charges were dropped.
Okay, when you said it never happened, I was like, what happened to Louise?
I know, yeah, I know. I was like, immediately,
was she
we're all like,
as well?
Murder, suicide, we don't know. No, they were basically like, shit, we couldn't get the mom on this. We're definitely not going to be able to get the daughter who's been institutionalized. And part of it, too, was at the time, this narrative of Louise being like this tragic, broken beauty of a person was getting weaved around, and especially with the rumors of potential abuse, people were starting to feel really bad for her. So part of the prosecutor's plan was to convict Mina, and then it's like, well, if she did it, then we can definitely get Louise on something. But right. If they couldn't even get Mina on murder, mm-hmm. they couldn't get Louise on anything else. The murder of Louis Arbogast is still unsolved, and it will likely remain that way. After the acquittal and drop charges, all of the Arbogast women refused to discuss the case. Instead of going their separate ways and attempt to like distance themselves from the trauma and accusations and just the pure like national news drama that they'd endured, the Arbogast women instead grew closer. They became partners in the butcher shop, which Louis had started, with Louise acting as the bookkeeper until she got married and moved to Rochester, Michigan. Not where we are, Michigan. I was very disappointed with the second part of that sentence. And they all maintained their silence for the rest of their lives. Like throughout the investigation, they really didn't give the cops anything. And Mina only broke under like really intense interrogation. And after it all kind of like blew over, they just really like doubled down and were like, nope, it's over. Deal with it.
Well, because there's a good chance if the father was doing that to one daughter, he could have been doing it to all of them.
Yeah. So it was like this weird collusion of silence. We don't know much about Louise's life in Michigan. She appears in the historical record again only when she dies in 1930 at 38 years old.
Aww.
So young. She reportedly died of apoplexy, which could have been anything from a heart attack or a stroke, arsenic, who knows? Car accident.
Fire.
Yeah. And she and her husband had no children. And that is the story of the women who were to be seen but not heard, and the murder of Louis Arbogast.
So honestly, I think Flora, the like daughter that told the story, I think she's the most believable. And I think, yeah, that none of the other like family got to her to be like, hey, this is the story. And that's why I think that it was probably the mom.
My money's on the mom.
Maybe it was both. Maybe one, like maybe Luis hit him with the axe and then the mom was like, well, shit, we have to cover this up. And so it was the mom that was like, grab the gasoline, let's light him on fire.
You know, that's actually really interesting because they're obviously like whatever happened. I think all of the women in that family know what happened.
Oh,
for
yeah.
real. Mm-hmm. And there's
they were all in on it by the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they all like, you know, held the axe and had a hand in committing it. But I kind of like the idea of like the mom and the daughter being in on it together. Like, I'm not usually for like colluding with murder, but it seems like he was not a nice man to them. And at best, he was going to abandon the family. Like,
yeah,
I feel like if it was at all premeditated, they should have told the other daughters beforehand. Like, just I feel like I have a feeling it wasn't totally premeditated because no one warned Flora.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe that was their whole thing, is that they were like, you know, we'll just confuse everyone.
Yeah.
That way they can't pin everything on one person because not everyone's saying it's the same person.
I would be so curious as to like what physical evidence they could find nowadays, because the reason that this murder has gone quote unquote unsolved is because all the people who were there refused to talk about it. Their silence kind of was their savior in that aspect, but we know that whose fingerprints are on the axe, whose blood is in the room, you know, bloody feet print. I don't know. Like,
yeah. Whose footprints does the bloody feet print match?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like even in 1909, they could have done that. Like, girl, sit down. Let me look at your feet.
No, back to the hunch.
Yeah.
So like, every girl in my family weirdly has the same size shoe, so I could understand that, like, you couldn't tell these girls' feet pins apart.
Yeah, but you'd think, like, whoever it was probably still had blood on the bottom of their feet. That's why I'm saying, like, have them sit down and look at the bottom of their feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sketchy to me that Mina changed her dress, her nightgown. That seems
like,
really odd to me.
I definitely think the mom had something to do with it. 100%. But I also still think Luis had something to do with it.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. So here's my story.
Okay.
So Luis was about to, you know, be assaulted again by her father. And she decided that this time was just too much and just snaps and hits him with an axe. And then the mom comes out of the bathroom and hears, because she heard, you know, her husband's skull being broken. And
as one does.
And sees her daughter standing over the father with a bloody axe and is like, well, we all knew what he was doing. Where's the gasoline?
Yep. I think that's probably what happened.
I almost wonder if it was, it may not have been premeditated, like, for days, but the fact that he was, so the bed is like this, and he's face down across it making a T, because it sounds like he was attacked from behind, like, well, he was facing the bed.
Supposedly people also tried to, like, pull him off the bed, so that might be why he was...
Yeah, but the axe wounds were in the back of his head.
Oh, yeah, I knew he was definitely attacked from behind. So maybe yeah. It was he was assaulting Luis, and then the mom came up and hit him in the back of the head. And then the two of them were like, well, we have to cover this up because, you know.
Yeah, see, and I don't even think necessarily something had to be happening at the time of his murder. Like, I think it could have also been like, this is building up. Because that's actually pretty common. Because if you think about it, okay, let's assume he's abusive. He's been able to exert control over you and abuse you for this long. You kind of have to take the abuser out when they're not expecting it.
True.
You know, like you hear these stories of people who endure a lot of abuse and then they murder their abuser. And it's like, well, they were sleeping on the couch when it happened. So that's not self-defense. Well, that's the only way I could get them because they've been abusing me for 8 years. Like.
Was so, I going to do? Wait till he was actively trying to hurt me?
Yeah, like, right. If I could do that, this wouldn't be happening.
Yeah. But no, I think we're all on the right track that it was probably some combination of the mom and the oldest daughter.
I really want to. I'm so curious. But yeah.
Well, if you ever get a time machine, a Emily.
Yes.
We know where she's going.
Gonna hang out with Isidore.
Yeah. No, you have to go before that.
Yes.
Because if you show up with Isidore, you're still not gonna know what happened.
True, true, true.
Bring a little, like, vial with you and, like, collect all this. Like, bring a suitcase, collect all this evidence, bring it back here.
I'm gonna bring that.
Test all of this shit.
I'm gonna bring that mattress back with me. It's gonna be really weird getting through time travel customs, but I think I can do it.
Yeah.
So,
like, it was going to be burned anyway.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't exist in the past anymore. It's fine.
Yeah, shut up. Stop giving me a hard time about this.
I was thinking more of, like, are you carrying more than, like, a certain amount of money worth of goods through customs or, like, live animal products?
Well, is human blood an animal product?
I got a bunch of butcher meat and a bloody mattress.
And some hair
you
fibers.
Guess what I was doing.
Yeah. Don't worry about the bloody axe. That's for the folks at home.
It's for my basement, guys.
I needed a nice conversation piece.
Oh, that's funny.
So at the end of all of our episodes, we like to talk about what we're thankful for. And personally, we are both thankful that you were able to join us today.
This has been
so much fun. I cannot believe I've never heard of that Georgia female serial killer.
I know.
What a batshit crazy story.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having us. This was so much fun.
It was.
We're so glad that you could join us. And hopefully this is the first of many collabs.
Yeah, next time we'll have you guys on our show. It'll be super fun.
Please
do.
We
love that.
I love because I feel like, you know, you guys are obviously very chaotic. It's the Chaos Cast. I just feel like our brands of chaos have just, like, melded together so beautifully and seamlessly.
I just, when the video opened and you were sitting there in the same costume as me, I was just like, oh my God.
This didn't get recorded, but she pops up on the video. I was like, are you fucking Rosie the Riveter? I am shitting
so
my pants
funny.
Right now. Oh, it's amazing.
It was very loud. I was like in the other room having something. And I was just
everyone
like, oh,
in
Emily.
The neighborhood knows I shit my pants. Well, Ellen and Sam, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell our listeners again where to find you, lovelies?
Of course. Ellen, you want to do it this time? Do you know it?
I always remember. Okay. We are the Chaos Cast. You can find us at Chaos Pod on Instagram.
No.
What so is close. Our Instagram?
It's Chaos Podcast.
At Chaos Podcast on Instagram.
Also at underscore Chaos Podcast on Twitter. And you can also email us at chaospodcast21@gmail.com. All of those places have all of the links to our show on whatever platform you like.
That's okay. We still screw ours up and we're like 122 episodes in.
It's not as often anymore.
So I do it at the end of every episode. So I was mostly just testing Ellen to see if she knew it.
We split it at the end of our episodes.
I love that your podcast is Let's Pick on Ellen.
Yeah.
Oh, that is what our podcast
That is too often what happens.
I research and then I pick on Ellen with information.
Love it. Love it.
And then she has to edit it.
Yeah, I get back at her usually with some kind of random terrible topic that I force her to learn about. It's great.
Yeah, because at the end of every one of her episodes, Ellen tells me about whatever hyperfixation she has that week, and it's very often very violent.
I mean, that's the fun stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, as far as history goes, that was always what I was interested in as a kid. Like, okay, how many people died? More than three? Let's do this.
Yeah, if you do like to learn about, this is going to be another plug completely for a different show, but Body Count Podcast.
Yeah, everyone dies. If you like murders
and stuff, you should go listen to that.
History with a Body Count.
Yeah, it's really good. Anyways.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sam and Ellen of the Chaos Cast. Definitely go check them out right after this episode. And as always, we are Whining About Herstory. You can like us at Whining About Herstory on Facebook, WAH Pod on Instagram,
WAH underscore pod on Twitter. Our website is whiningaboutherstory.com and our email is whiningaboutherstory@gmail.com, where we would love to hear from you. We also have a Patreon. If you search Whining About Herstory, you can donate for as little as $1.
$1.
Keep the wine flowing.
Keep it flowing into my liver.
Just directly. She has this little, like, funnel just directly into the liver.
I was actually, like, I was so tired today, and I was like, so where's the coffee IV that I desperately need?
That's a mood.
All right. Well, as always, I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
I'm Sam.
I'm Ellen.
And have an empowered day.
Bye! Bye.